this is Scott Sischer, Deputy Editor of the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology in Practice, and I'm excited to present the highlights of our March 2024 theme issue, where the theme is, drumroll please, or should I say drumsticks please, food allergy. We want to thank our editorial board members Julie Wang and Robert Wood for doing a fantastic job coordinating this theme issue, and also co-authoring review articles, and for contributing a theme editorial that does an amazing job summarizing and contextualizing the reviews in this issue and the theme in general. The thematic reviews in this theme issue include clinical commentary reviews entitled New Approaches to Food Allergy Immunotherapy, and that comes with CME, The Role of Biologics in the Treatment of Food Allergy, also with CME, Addressing Health Equity in Food Allergy, also with CME, Identifying Children at Risk of Growth and Nutrient Deficiencies in the Food Allergy Clinic, and Non-Allergic Diseases Associated with Foods. There are also Grand Round reviews entitled Comprehensive Diagnosis, Management, and Treatment of Sesame Allergy with CME, and another one entitled Diagnosis and Management of Pollen Food Allergy Syndrome to Nuts. There is an additional theme editorial entitled Challenges of Oral Immunotherapy for Food Allergy During a National Crisis. And there are two rostra. One is entitled FLEXIT, Applying Platform Trials Methodology to Immunotherapy for Food Allergy in Research and Clinical Practice. And another one entitled Personalization of Complementary Feeding in Children with Acute Food Protein-Induced Enterocolitis Syndrome. There's a workgroup report on a different topic, this one about factors influencing career choice of allergy and immunology fellows in training. And when you're reading this theme issue, don't forget that we also have 8 clinical communications that are on food allergy topics as well as other original articles on a variety of topics. And I'll present summaries of the full-length original articles in this issue, and these will cover the following areas in formation: food allergy, asthma, drug allergy, eosinophilic disorders, hereditary angioedema, immunodeficiency, and mast cell disorders. The first article is entitled Real-World Sensitization and Tolerance Pattern to Seafood in Fish Allergic Individuals by Leung et al. What's already known about this topic? Although significant cross-reactivity between fish species occurred, tolerance to selective fish has been reported, but limited to small case series. Data on IgE sensitization and clinical reactivity to fish and shellfish are limited. What does this article add to our knowledge? The article identified 40% of fish allergic individuals being tolerant to selected fish, more commonly to fish with low beta parvalbumin levels. An IgE sensitization gradient corresponded to the beta parvalbumin levels of fish. Shellfish avoidance was common in non-shellfish sensitized individuals, while IgE sensitization with clinical tolerance of shellfish was common. How does the study impact current management guidelines? The study provided evidence that fish allergic individuals may exhibit selective tolerance towards specific types of fish, and acutely diagnosing shellfish allergies with conventional tests remains challenging. Precision medicine is necessary for seafood allergies. The next article is entitled Rates of New Peanut Allergy and Discontinuation Following Introduction in High-Risk Infants by Banerjee et al. What's already known about this topic? Introduction of 6 grams of peanut protein weekly is recommended in 4 to 6-month-old infants with severe eczema and or egg allergy. What does the article add to our knowledge? New peanut allergy after introduction is rare, and ongoing peanut exposure is feasible, though fear of reaction in household members is a common reason for discontinuation. Protective effects of peanut may occur with less than 6 grams weekly. How does the study impact current management guidelines? Targeted support of families with peanut allergic members may be needed. The dose of peanut needed to prevent peanut allergy may be lower than current guidelines. The next article is entitled Home-Based Double-Blind Placebo-Controlled Challenges for Diagnosis of Delayed Gluten or Milk Hypersensitivity in Children by Landas et al. What's already known about the topic? Hypersensitivity to gluten and milk protein is reported by around 15% of the population. Better diagnostic tools to investigate delayed food hypersensitivity are needed, as unnecessary diets may cause malnutrition and impaired growth in children. What does the article add to our knowledge? They present a home-based method for diagnosing delayed milk and gluten hypersensitivity, by which milk and gluten were refuted as a trigger in 75% of children, and most succeed in reintroduction despite a history of a long-term restrictive diet. How does this study impact current management guidelines? Home-based, double-blind, placebo-controlled food challenges may be an effective tool in avoiding unnecessary elimination diets in children. The procedure can be performed at home in collaboration with an outpatient clinic. The next article is entitled Partial Egg Consumption Modifies the Diagnostic Performance of Allergy Tests to Predict Outcomes of Double-Blind Placebo-Controlled Food Challenges to Egg by Marcus Mejias et al. What is already known about the topic? Allergy tests, including skin prick test and specific immunoglobulin E, can support the diagnosis of IgE-mediated egg allergy. What does this article add to our knowledge? Egg consumption can modify the predictive value of allergy tests, with the basophil activation test being most accurate in egg partial consumers. How does the study impact current management guidelines? Assessing egg consumption when diagnosing egg allergy can inform the interpretation of test results and allow greater diagnostic precision. The next article is entitled Infant Whole Cell versus Acellular Pertussis Vaccination in 1997 to 1999 and the Risk of Childhood Hospitalization for Food-Induced Anaphylaxis, Linked Administrative Database Cohort Study by Perez Chacon et al. What's already known about this topic? Allergist-diagnosed IgE-mediated food allergy was reported to be less likely among Australian-born children receiving a first dose of whole cell pertussis vaccine, WP, compared with those vaccinated with acellular pertussis vaccine, AP. What does the article add to our knowledge? In a cohort of nearly 220,000 Australian children, a first dose of WP vaccine before age 4 months, rather than the acellular pertussis vaccine, was associated with a 53% lower risk of hospitalization for food-induced anaphylaxis at ages 5 to 15 years. That's an incident rate where, when vaccinated with the whole pertussis as a first dose, 3.5 per 100,000 child years, with a 95% confidence interval of 2.6 to 4.6, and 5.1 per 100,000 child years, with a 95% confidence interval of 3.5 to 7.1, when vaccinated with the acellular as a first dose, adjusted hazard ratio being 0.47, 95% confidence interval, 0.26 to 0.83. How does this study impact current management guidelines? The study supports the conduct of ongoing randomized controlled trials examining the effects of a first dose of a whole pertussis versus acellular pertussis vaccine on the prevention of IgE-mediated food allergy. The next article is entitled Food Allergy Reaction Severity and Management in a Diverse Population by K. Green et al. What's already known about the topic? Food allergy reactions, especially those that progress to anaphylaxis, are hypothesized to be affected by socioeconomic factors such as income and race and ethnicity, but little data exists to describe the relationship between these factors. What does the article add to our knowledge? They demonstrate that non-Hispanic black children had higher odds of severe reactions and increased emergency room use, and both non-Hispanic black and Hispanic Latino children had lower rates of lifetime epinephrine use compared with non-Hispanic white children. How does the study impact current management guidelines? Patients who report severe reactions and demonstrate increased emergency room use with decreased epinephrine use should be offered resources and training on definitive management of various food allergy reactions. The next article is entitled Clinical Subtypes of Neutrophilic Asthma, a Cluster Analysis from Australasian Severe Asthma Network by He et al. What's already known about the topic? Clinical heterogeneity may exist with asthma subtypes defined by inflammatory markers. However, the heterogeneity of neutrophilic asthma has been largely unexplored. What does the article add to our knowledge? Three clinical subtypes of neutrophilic asthma were identified. Cluster 1, a mild and transient subtype. Cluster 2, comorbid anxiety-depressive symptoms with poorly controlled neutrophilic asthma with persistent airway neutrophilia. And Cluster 3, an asthma chronic obstructive pulmonary disease subtype. How does the study impact current management guidelines? This study indicates that heterogeneity exists in neutrophilic asthma and that the subtypes are characterized by distinct features relevant to clinical practice, which has implications for the management of neutrophilic asthma. The next article is entitled Vitamin B12 Hypersensitivity, a Retrospective Multicenter Study by L. Ramul et al. What's already known about the topic? Rare cases of immediate and delayed hypersensitivity reactions to vitamin B12 replacement, cyanocobalamin and hydroxycobalamin, have been reported. What does the article add to our knowledge? This is the largest series of patients investigated for suspected vitamin B12 allergy. Immediate hypersensitivity is more common than delayed hypersensitivity. In oral preparation, excipients can be the cause of hypersensitivity. How does this impact current management guidelines? The study confirms the validity of vitamin B12 skin tests and the role of excipient allergy testing. It provides comprehensive diagnostic pathways for vitamin B12 allergy. The next article is entitled Skin Test Reactivity Patterns in Patients Allergic to Iodinated Contrast Media, a Refined View by Giordanescu et al. What's already known about the topic? Current two-dimensional classifications of iodinated contrast media, abbreviated ICM, into 3 to 8 chemical classes are insufficient to explain observed skin test reactivity patterns in patients with hypersensitivity reactions to ICM. What does the article add to our knowledge? Odds ratio suggests significant association between classical cross-reactive ICM and some uncommon associations among ICM belonging to different chemical classes. We relate the uncommon associations to similarities in the three-dimensional structure among the products. How does the study impact current management guidelines? The odds ratio for skin test co-reactivity identifying positively or negatively associated ICM could be used, combined with data from re-exposure and in silico models, as well as drug provocation tests whenever possible, to guide or refine the choice for an alternative ICM. However, validation using an independent cohort is imperative. The next article is entitled Performance Characteristics of Basophil Activation Tests for Diagnosing Penicillin Allergy, a Meta-Analysis by Bennett et al. What's already known about the topic? The basophil activation test, or BAT, is an in vitro test that can help ascertain a diagnosis of penicillin allergy. However, in part owing to heterogeneity in implementation of BAT, the sensitivity of this test is unclear. What does this article add to our knowledge? Using flow cytometry as a positive threshold of 2, BAT sensitivity was 51%, 95% confidence interval was 46 to 56%, and specificity 89%, then 95% confidence was 85 to 93%. Using a minimum of 500 or 1,000 basophils per test gave similar results. How does this study impact current management guidelines? The BAT had improved sensitivity but lower specificity than specific IgE, another in vitro test, for diagnosing penicillin allergy. Future work exploring the use of BAT and penicillin allergy diagnosis is required before it can be considered for use in clinical practice. The next article is entitled Long-Term Effectiveness of Benralizumab in Eosinophilic Granulomatosis with Polyangiitis by Nanzer et al. What's already known about the topic? Organ-specific pathology in eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, and I'll be saying EGPA, can be the result of eosinophilic tissue infiltration. Biologic therapies that target eosinophils by blocking the cytokine IL-5 results in remission rates in up to a third of patients. What does this article add to our knowledge? Benralizumab blocks the anti-IL-5 receptor, leading to more profound depletion of eosinophils. Data presented here demonstrate remission rates in up to two-thirds of patients, sustained over 2 years, and with significant corticosteroid-sparing capacity. How does this impact management guidelines? Anti-IL-5 or 5 receptor biologic agents offer a safe and better-tolerated treatment approach compared with oral corticosteroids and other broad-spectrum immunosuppressive therapies, and should be considered first-line in patients with relapsing or refractory EGPA. The next article is entitled Once Daily Berotralstat for Long-Term Prophylaxis of Hereditary Angioedema, the Open-Label Extension of the APEX-2 Randomized Trials by Kiani Alakan et al. What's already known about the topic? Berotralstat, which is approved for the prophylaxis of hereditary angioedema attacks in patients 12 years or older, was shown to be well-tolerated and effective over 48 weeks in Part 1 and Part 2 of the APEX-2 randomized Phase 3 study. What does this article add to our knowledge? In APEX 2 Part 3, once daily oral berotralstat for prophylaxis of hereditary angioedema attacks was well tolerated long-term and led to sustained improvements in attack rates and patient-reported outcomes over 96 weeks of treatment. How does the study impact current management guidelines? Long-term prophylaxis with once-daily oral berotralstat is an effective and well-tolerated non-parenteral treatment option for patients living with hereditary angioedema. The next article is entitled Unraveling the Natural History of Good Syndrome, a Progressive Adult Combined Immunodeficiency by Kabir et al. What's already known about the topic? Good syndrome is a rare adult combined immune deficiency. It has been classified in general terms as thymoma and immune deficiency. The natural history and long-term outcomes of the disease remain unknown. What does the article add to our knowledge? This is the first prospective, longitudinal cohort study of patients with Good syndrome. It documents the long-term immune hematologic and clinical evolution of a cohort of patients from a single center. How does this study impact current management guidelines? In addition to monitoring of immunoglobulin levels and early initiation of immunoglobulin replacement therapy, we recommend monitoring for progressive cytopenias. We also recommend maintaining a high index of suspicion for opportunistic infections with consideration for early antimicrobial prophylaxis. And the final full-length article is Low Prevalence of Idiopathic Mast Cell Activation Syndrome Among 703 Patients with Suspected Mast Cell Disorders by Zagmount et al. What's already known about this topic? Idiopathic Mast Cell Activation Syndrome, IMCAS, is characterized by severe, systemic, and recurrent symptoms of mast cell activation with non-clonal etiologies. Studies indicating the prevalence of IMCAS using evidence-based diagnostic criteria are lacking. What does the article add to our knowledge? Our findings indicate that IMCAS is an uncommon condition among patients suspected of having mast cell disorders. However, its prevalence was higher, 27%, in patients with unprovoked anaphylaxis in the current cohort. How does this study impact current management guidelines? Anaphylaxis appears to be the archetype of MCAS. For diagnosing IMCAS, it's crucial to screen suspected patients using the three diagnostic criteria, perform the blood detection of D816V mutations, and apply recommended diagnostic algorithms. That's a wrap. This is Scott Sicherer. Thank you for listening to the Highlights podcast for this theme issue on food allergy. I hope you enjoyed hearing these article highlights, and I encourage you to read through the entire theme issue as the editors are confident that the information is going to be valuable to you and your patients. Thank you again for listening.